Chapter 4. Far from translating, she pretended to eat a little of the furmity with the leaden spoon offered, and as she did so said blandly to the hag, "You've seen better days?" "Ah, ma'am, well ye may say it," responded the old woman, opening the sluices of her heart forthwith. "I've stood in this fair ground, maid, wife, and widow, these 39 years, and in that time have known what it was to do business with the richest stomachs in the land. Ma'am, you'd hardly believe that I was once the owner of a great pavilion tent that was the attraction of the fair. Nobody could come, nobody could go, without having a dish of Mrs. Goodenough's furmity. I knew the clergy's taste, the dandy gent's taste. I knew the town's taste, the country's taste. I even knowed the taste of the coarse shameless females. But Lord's my life, the world's no memory. Straightforward dealings don't bring profit is the sly, and the underhand, that get on in these times." Mrs. Newson glanced round, her daughter was still bending over the distant stalls. "A new call to mind," she said cautiously to the old woman, "the sale of a wife by her husband in your tent 18 years ago today?" The hag reflected, and half shook her head. "If it had been a big thing I should have minded it in a moment," she said. "I can mind every serious fight o' married parties, every murder, every manslaughter, even every pocket-picking leastwise large ones, that he has been my lot to witness. But a selling? Was it done quiet-like?" "Well, yes. I think so." The furmity woman half shook her head again. "And yet," she said, "I do. At any rate, I can mind a man doing something o' the sort, a man in a cord jacket, with a basket of tools. But, Lord bless ye, we don't guy it headroom, we don't, such as that. The only reason why I can mind the man is that he came back here to the next year's fair, and told me quite private-like that, if a woman ever asked for him, I was to say he had gone to where? Casterbridge, yes, to Casterbridge," said he. "But, Lord's my life, I shouldn't ha' thought of it again." Mrs. Newson would have rewarded the old woman as far as her small means afforded had she not discreetly borne in mind that it was by that unscrupulous person's liquor her husband had been degraded. She briefly thanked her informant, and rejoined Elizabeth, who greeted her with, "Mother, do let's get on, it was hardly respectable for you to buy refreshments there. I see none, but the lowest do." "I have learned what I wanted, however," said her mother quietly. "He last time our relative visited this fair he said he was living at Casterbridge. It is a long, long way from here, and it was many years ago that he said it, but there I think we'll go." With this they descended out of the fair, and went onward to the village, where they obtained a night's lodging. 4. Henchard's wife acted for the best, but as he had involved herself in difficulties. 100 times as he had been upon the point of telling her daughter Elizabeth Jane the true story of her life, the tragical crisis of which had been the transaction at Wagdon Fair, when she was not much older than the girl now beside her. But as he had refrained, an innocent maiden had thus grown up in the belief that the relations between the genial sailor and her mother were the ordinary ones that they had always appeared to be. The risk of endangering a child's strong affection by disturbing ideas which had grown with her growth was to Mrs. Henchard too fearful a thing to contemplate. It had seemed, indeed, folly to think of making Elizabeth Jane wise. But Susan Henchard's fear of losing her dearly loved daughter's heart by a revelation had little to do with any sense of wrongdoing on her own part. Her simplicity, the original ground of Henchard's contempt for her, had allowed her to live on in the conviction that Newson had acquired a morally real and justifiable right to her by his purchase, though the exact bearings and legal limits of that right were vague. It may seem strange to sophisticated minds that a sane young matron could believe in the seriousness of such a transfer, and were there not numerous other instances of the same belief, the thing might scarcely be credited. But she was by no means the first or last peasant woman who had religiously adhered to her purchaser, as too many rural records show. The history of Susan Henchard's adventures in the interim can be told in two or three sentences. Absolutely helpless as he had been taken off to Canada, where they had lived several years without any great worldly success, though she worked as hard as any woman could to keep their cottage cheerful and well provided. When Elizabeth Jane was about 12 years old, the three returned to England and settled at Falmouth, where Newson made a living for a few years as boatman and general handy shoreman. He then engaged in the Newfoundland trade, and it was during this period that Susan had an awakening. A friend to whom she confided her history ridiculed her grave acceptance of her position, and all was over with her peace of mind. When Newson came home at the end of one winter, he saw that the delusion he had so carefully sustained had vanished forever. There was then a time of sadness, in which she told him her doubts, if she could live with him longer. Newson left home again on the Newfoundland trade, when the season came round. The vague news of his loss at sea a little later on solved a problem which had become torture to her meek conscience. She saw him no more. Of Henchard they heard nothing. To the leech subjects of labor, the England of those days was a continent, and a mile a geographical degree. Elizabeth Jane developed early into womanliness. One day a month or so after receiving intelligence of Newson's death off the bank of Newfoundland, when the girl was about 18, she was sitting on a willow chair in the cottage they still occupied, working twine nets for the fishermen. Her mother was in a back corner of the same room engaged in the same labor, and dropping the heavy wood needle she was filling, she surveyed her daughter thoughtfully. The sun shone in at the door upon the young woman's head and hair, which was worn loose, so that the rays streamed into its depths as into a hazel copse. Her face, though somewhat wan and incomplete, possessed the raw materials of beauty in a promising degree. There was an under-handsomeness in it, struggling to reveal itself through the provisional curves of immaturity, and the casual disfigurements, that resulted from the straitened circumstances of their lives. She was handsome in the bone, hardly as yet handsome in the flesh. She possibly might never be fully handsome, unless the carking accidents of her daily existence could be evaded before the mobile parts of her countenance had settled to their final mold. The sight of the girl made her mother sad not vaguely, but by logical inference. They both were still in that strait waistcoat of poverty from which as he had tried, so many times to be delivered for the girl's sake. The woman had long perceived how zealously and constantly the young mind of her companion was struggling for enlargement, and yet now, in her 18th year, it still remained but little unfolded. The desire sober and repressed of Elizabeth Jane's heart was indeed to see, to hear, and to understand. How could she become a woman of wider knowledge, higher repute, better, as she termed it? This was her constant inquiry of her mother. She sought further into things than other girls in her position ever did, and her mother groaned as she felt she could not aid in the search. The sailor, drowned or no, was probably now lost to them, and Susan's staunch, religious adherence to him as her husband in principle, till her views had been disturbed by enlightenment, was demanded no more. She asked herself whether the present moment, now that she was a free woman again, were not as opportune a one as she would find in a world where everything had been so inopportune, for making a desperate effort to advance Elizabeth. To pocket her pride and search for the first husband seemed, wisely or not, the best initiatory step. He had possibly drunk himself into his tomb. But he might, on the other hand, have had too much sense to do so, for in her time with him, he had been given to bouts only, and was not a habitual drunkard. At any rate, the propriety of returning to him, if he lived, was unquestionable. The awkwardness of searching for him lay in enlightening Elizabeth, a proceeding which her mother could not endure to contemplate. She finally resolved to undertake the search without confiding to the girl her former relations with Henchard, leaving it to him, if they found him, to take what steps he might choose to that end. This will account for their conversation at the fair, and the half-informed state at which Elizabeth was led onward. In this attitude they proceeded on their journey, trusting solely to the dim light afforded of Henchard's whereabouts by the furmity woman. The strictest economy was indispensable. Sometimes they might have been seen on foot, sometimes on farmers' wagons, sometimes in carriers' vans, and thus they drew near to Casterbridge. Elizabeth Jane discovered to her alarm that her mother's health was not what it once had been, and there was ever and anon in her talk that renunciatory tone which showed that, but for the girl, she would not be very sorry to quit a life she was growing thoroughly weary of. It was on a Friday evening, near the middle of September, and just before dusk, that they reached the summit of a hill within a mile of the place they sought. There were high banked edges to the coach road here, and they mounted upon the green turf within, and sat down. The spot commanded a full view of the town and its environs. "What an old-fashioned place it seems to be," said Elizabeth Jane, while her silent mother mused on other things than topography. "Tea is huddled altogether, and it is shut in by a square wall of trees, like a plot of garden ground by a box edging." Its squareness was, indeed, the characteristic which most struck the eye in this antiquated borough, the borough of Casterbridge at that time, recent as it was, untouched by the faintest sprinkle of modernism. It was compact as a box of dominoes. It had no suburbs in the ordinary sense. Country and town met at a mathematical line. To birds of the more soaring kind, Casterbridge must have appeared on this fine evening as a mosaic work of subdued reds, browns, grays, and crystals, held together by a rectangular frame of deep green. To the level eye of humanity it stood as an indistinct mass behind a dense stockade of limes and chestnuts, set in the midst of miles of rotund down and concave field. The mass became gradually dissected by the vision into towers, gables, chimneys, and casements, the highest glazings shining bleared and bloodshot with the coppery fire they caught from the belt of sunlit cloud in the west. From the center of each side of this tree-bound square ran avenues east, west, and south into the wide expanse of corn land and coombe to the distance of a mile or so. It was by one of these avenues that the pedestrians were about to enter. Before they had risen to proceed, two men passed outside the hedge, engaged in argumentative conversation. "Why, surely," said Elizabeth, as they receded, "those men mentioned the name of Henchard in their talk, the name of our relative." "I thought so too," said Mrs. Newson. "That seems a hint to us that he is still here." "Yes. Shall I run after them, and ask them about him?" "No, no, no. Not for the world just yet. He may be in the workhouse, or in the stocks, for all we know." "Dear me, why should you think that, Mother?" "'Twas just something to say, that's all. But we must make private inquiries." Having sufficiently rested, they proceeded on their way at evenfall. The dense trees of the avenue rendered the road dark as a tunnel, though the open land on each side was still under a faint daylight. In other words, they passed down a midnight between two gloamings. The features of the town had a keen interest for Elizabeth's mother, now that the human side came to the fore. As soon as they had wandered about, they could see that the stockade of gnarled trees which framed in Casterbridge was itself an avenue, standing on a low green bank or escarpment, with a ditch yet visible without. Within the avenue and bank was a wall more or less discontinuous, and within the wall were packed the abodes of the burghers. Though the two women did not know that these external features were but the ancient defenses of the town, planted as a promenade. The lamplights now glimmered through the engirdling trees, conveying a sense of great smugness and comfort inside, and rendering at the same time the unlighted country without strangely solitary and vacant in aspect, considering its nearness to life. The difference between Berg and Champagne was increased, too, by sounds which now reached them above others, the notes of a brass band. The travelers returned into the high street, where there were timber houses with overhanging stories, whose small paned lattices were screened by dimity curtains on a drawing string, and under whose archboards old cobwebs waved in the breeze. There were houses of brick noggin, which derived their chief support from those adjoining. There were slate roofs patched with tiles, and tile roofs patched with slate, with occasionally a roof of thatch. The agricultural and pastoral character of the people upon whom the town depended for its existence was shown by the class of objects displayed in the shop windows. Scythes, reap hooks, sheep shears, bill hooks, spades, mattocks, and hoes at the ironmongers, beehives, butter firkins, churns, milking stools and pails, hay rakes, field flagons, and seed lips at the coopers, cart ropes and plow harness at the saddlers, carts, wheelbarrows, and mill gear at the wheelwrights and machinists, horse embrocations at the chemists, at the glovers and leather cutters, hedging gloves, thatcher's kneecaps, plowman's leggings. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.